Good.
Yeah, great. Okay. Couple things I want to say. This topic we're touching on around truth and reconciliation, I've noticed something that keeps happening when I'm talking about it, is I keep saying the word we, as in, like, we white folks, and what I realized is I really don't want to say that, because we are part of a multicultural church. There are a lot of people in our community that are Indigenous, that have connection to the Indigenous community. There's Métis people in our community. There's people that are First Nation. I don't know of any Inuit people in our community, but, you know, they're welcome. They'd be welcome as well. And so when we say we, or we approach the topic that we're talking about as if we're all kind of coming from the same vantage point, then we're ignorant to the fact that already we haven't read the room. And so if you hear me say that, I'm sorry in advance. I don't want to say that. I don't want to think that way. I also want to say I'm really grateful for masks these days, because I'm growing this hideous thing on my face. I feel like it's just the elephant in the room that I have to own it. I hate the mustache, but I love the cause. Okay, so November is a time where we're trying to bring awareness around prostate cancer for men. And so that is why that little hamster is living above my lip right now. But that was for me. I can let it go and move on. So today I want to preach two sermons, or I want to give two talks. And then I want to talk about how they connect and how they, I think, matter for the way we look at things in our community. So if the sermon is your least favorite part, I'm sorry, twice. And if it's your favorite, it's a two-for-one deal today. So here we go. A couple weeks ago, we started with this question around the Good Samaritan. And it's a question that comes in the book of Luke, where Jesus is hanging out with Pharisees and religious leaders. And one of them says to him, "Teacher, what do we have to do to inherit eternal life?" Remember this? And so Jesus, he says, "Well, what does the law, what does the Torah tell you you have to do?" And the answer, and it's a good answer, says, says to love the Lord God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. And then you remember the second part? Love your neighbor as yourself. Yeah. So it's like love God, love neighbor, love self. Which objectively is a pretty easy answer to get behind. But then the person presses in a bit and says, "Okay, yeah, fine and good. That's what I think too. But here's where it gets a little bit sticky. Who is my neighbor?" And that's what launches this story of the Good Samaritan. And so today, rather than tell a story that you've heard a whole bunch of times before, I want to ask you, if you were trying to tell that story in our context here in Canada, the way that Jesus did, with some of the impulses that Jesus had as far as the characters depicted in the story, how would you tell it? Who would you choose as the characters of the story? Here's a shot that I'm taking at the story. It's probably not perfect. Guaranteed it's not perfect. But hopefully it gets at a couple of the instincts that Jesus had around some of the things he was trying to do with the story. Let me just say, this is a made-up story. Some of the details of it are accurate, but a lot of them aren't. Okay? So here's my version. And before you're too harsh, think about how you would do your version. Okay? So in Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, there is a town about an hour from there is called Waskasoo. And it's about an hour drive from Prince Albert to Waskasoo. It's in northern Saskatchewan, not as far north as really north is, but kind of in that northern area, enough where the Indigenous population in Prince Albert represents 29% of the city. And so it's a place where Indigenous and white people have a lot of exchanges. And now in between Waskasoo and Prince Albert, there's this rest stop. And this rest stop has a bit of a notorious sort of reputation. You see, what continually seems to be happening there is when people drive from Prince Albert to Waskasoo or Waskasoo to Prince Albert and need to stop at this rest stop, inevitably, especially late at night when there aren't many people around, when someone gets out of their car to head into the restroom, when they come out, there's been this trend that they get jumped. And people take everything that they can from the person, including their car, and they leave them sort of beat up and kind of cast aside in this rest stop. And so you're best to just avoid going to this rest stop. Like, don't drink too many coffees between Prince Albert and Waskasoo, because if you have to stop that rest stop, it's not a safe place. Well, one day, there was a man traveling from Prince Albert to Waskasoo who had to go to the bathroom. And so he stopped at the rest stop. He went in, and when he came out to his car, he got jumped. He got beaten he resisted, and so he was almost killed, and he was left for dead, leaning up against the wall of the bathroom house. Another car, luckily, came along, and it was a Catholic priest. He was on his way back from a spiritual retreat just beyond Waskasoo, heading back to Prince Albert. And he saw the guy, and he thought, oh, it's just so late, I'm so tired, and I've like been so filled up with this beautiful spirit that I don't want to get my hands dirty right now, I gotta go. And so he used the rest stop, he ignored the man, and he carried on his way. And then a short time later, headlights came into the rest stop one more time. This time it was a pastor from a church in Prince Albert who was heading to Waskasoo. He thought if he went up the night before, he could be ready for the pastor's meeting that he'd have the next day. And he also was tired, and he was in a rush because he wanted to get there before the hotel closed. And so when he saw the man, all the justification came up in him to say, really, no, I don't, I can't, I don't have time. So he went on his way. Shortly after, a man who was a Cree man came along. And this individual saw the person who'd been beaten, stopped, picked him up, and put him in his pickup truck. And then he drove his pickup truck to Prince Albert. He went to the emergency ward, waited with the man, and then took him to a local hotel where he was also staying. He gave the guy at the hotel his Visa card, and he said, whatever it costs, as long as this man needs to stay here, or if he needs a taxi back to the hospital, put it on my card. And then he went on his way. Who was neighborly? Good answer. The third man. You know, so we look at this story that we've heard a whole bunch of times, and really, there's a couple of things that are obvious about it, right? The guy says, who is my neighbor? But Jesus says, yeah, you're right, that if you want to inherit eternal life, love Lord God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, love your neighbor as yourself. Well, who's my neighbor then? Because maybe there's some wiggle room with things I don't want to have to do if I can somehow get some of the people out of the neighbor category and just focus on the neighbors I want to be neighborly toward. But Jesus seems to flip the question to say, rather than asking who your neighbor is, let's ask how to be neighborly. He never answers who the neighbor is. Really, not directly. He instead says, who acted neighborly? And so rather than saying, these kinds of people are your neighbors, he says, let's talk about what it means to be neighborly. Let's talk about what it means to extend ourselves into the world of people who are suffering, even if they're people we don't want to be neighbors with. Let's talk about how to be neighborly. And so kind of the obvious first point of the story, I think, is that to be neighborly means that rather than just loving people with our words or with our thoughts, that when we're called to action on their behalf, we step into that role and our love translates into real action. But here's the part that is causing me to scratch my head a little bit. Why is it that to tell this story the way that Jesus did, I have to use an indigenous person as the hero?
Mm-hmm.
You see, sometimes when we think about the Samaritan story, we forget the Samaritan is the one that the Jewish folks saw as unorthodox, as someone that didn't care about religion or about the law, that was dirty, that was a half-breed, that was someone that should be ostracized and not trusted, that they were probably the robber. Back to rob him again might have been the first reaction when they heard it was a Samaritan. And all the racist undertones that were present in that Jewish sort of sensibility around who Samaritans were, Jesus seems for some reason to say, rather than make the Samaritan the person who's beaten up on the side of the road, we're going to make the Samaritan the hero of the story. And so on the one hand, there's a lesson on how to be neighborly, but on the other, why is the Samaritan the hero of a story that has nothing to do with Samaritans? Like, why did Jesus pick the Samaritan? Or if we were trying to retell it in a way that's consistent with the impetus of the story, if we were in Prince Albert talking to a bunch of, say, white religious leaders, why would we say that an indigenous person in that place where there's a lot of tension between Cree people and white people, why would we make the indigenous, the Cree person, the hero of the story? And I think the reason is because there's something about changing the way we see people when they are viewed as human, when they're viewed as someone just like you and me that has just the same opportunity to be neighborly. It was the Samaritan, or in my telling of the story, it was the Cree man who was the neighbor, not because he was Cree, not because he helped someone that was whatever nationality. We don't even know the person that was hurt, what nationality they were. But it was because of the action that Jesus makes that person the hero of the story. But he purposely makes it a Samaritan because he seems to be saying something else. You know, and it reminds me of two things that have come out of our time processing this as a community, which is really kind of nice, right? It's just a reminder on what we're doing as a church with the experiment, is we're introducing a topic, and we're purposely not saying how we think about it, necessarily. We're putting it out there, and we're asking people in their discipleship, personal discipleship journey, to wrestle with this themselves, to not just sort of swallow the orthodox position or something, but to say, this is something that we need to be critically thinking about if we're living in Canada at this time. And so here's some of the facts. Now let's process together what God's Spirit might be saying to us as a community. Two of the things that came out of that processing, one from John and Jana, that's just been stuck with me, is that they've said that one of the things they see in the media in Canada is that for whatever reason, whenever we talk about Indigenous people, the stories seem to be the least flattering. Like, it's referencing victims of the residential school, which is an important thing to be referencing, or it's referencing people that are homeless or hurt, or that are suffering, or that are part of a culture that's been in crisis. But what Jana is saying is that her position and her understanding of Indigenous people and how beautiful and wonderful their culture is has drastically changed because she's often in a room where the leaders in the room are all Indigenous. Where she says she is not the smartest person in the room. She is not the most put together person in the room. There's countless times she's describing where she's been in the room with Indigenous leaders that are teaching her all kinds of very meaningful things. And so her little nudge to us as a community has been ringing in my ears that we need to sometimes look at what we see based on what we're hearing in the media and how we're imagining what the story is for thousands of people across Canada with a very small imagination of what that actually means. Now that's something that's sticking with me. And then the second thing that's kind of come out of this from Allison's Allison's nudges, is that when we hear the story of how broken and how difficult and how hard some of the Indigenous experience in the last 100 years or so, the last 200 years or so in Canada has been, our knee-jerk reaction might be to feel some pity, to feel like we've got to express pity. But Allison so rightly says that she thinks the proper response is not pity, but respect. Say the way to be neighborly is to respect people in the way they deserve to be respected in the first place. And the way to respect people is to say, let me understand how your culture is still in crisis and how some of the things that have happened will take generations probably to be healed. Let me be respectful of that and walk alongside you in this healing process. So that's the first sermon. One now. Hanging with me? Do we need like an intermission where we all get it? No. Order some pizza, love Michael and get some cash from the ATM. Yeah, all right. Second sermon, second talk. The first one was about what does it mean to be a neighbor. This one is about what does it mean to love people that aren't like us. So in my prep for today, I got reading an article by someone I didn't expect to be reading, but really enjoyed, a guy by the name of D.A. Carson. He's a theologian, and in lots of the things that he thinks, we might disagree, but this article that I read of his, I found to be very thoughtful and very helpful for this topic. He talked about this article that he read, and it's from 1998. It was written by a person who went under the pseudonym John Travis, and they gave themselves a fake name because they were a couple that was working in a Muslim situation, in an Asian Muslim community, and so they didn't probably want to be identified in case their names got back for writing this article. And in the article, which is called The C1 to C6 Spectrum, practical tool for defining six types of Christ-centered communities, this couple described that in Asian Muslim communities, there's sort of six different ways that Christians are trying to establish community with Muslims. And this article ended up being something that got so much attention, more than anyone ever thought it would, where people started referencing it as an arguing point, because it gave this spectrum of the way Christians are supposed to work with folks that aren't Christians. Do you want to hear the six? I'll do them quick, okay? You're like, we have a choice. No choice. You can leave, I guess. Okay. So C1 to C6. So it's Christ-centered community one, Christ-centered community two, and so on. So Christ-centered community one looks like this. It's a traditional church, a traditional Western church, using a non-Indigenous language. So it'd be like an English-speaking church in the middle of Japan. Its believers exist as an ethnic or a religious community. The church is viewed as a foreign entity. It's like it's not part of the culture. For example, if you planted an English-speaking church in Japan. Okay, so that's C1. C2 is the same, but now they're using the Indigenous language. So it's a Western-style church. Everything looks and feels like it would in North America. It's just that we're speaking Japanese. Okay, so that's C2. So there's a little bit of missions work there where we're saying we're going to try to be like the culture that we're in. Okay, it gets less and less so as we go. So C3 is a Christ-centered community in the Indigenous language that's happy to adopt those cultural features of the local environment that are non-religious. Okay, so things that have nothing to do with religion, they're happy to adopt them. But if the people become converted and were once Muslims, they now think of themselves as former Muslims. I'm not a Muslim anymore on this now. And they're perceived to be former Muslims by their surrounding culture. Okay, so you're seeing that, like how that's getting kind of more and more close to the culture. So Yeah, keep going. C4. So the fourth one, they use the indigenous language, but now adopt many, let's say Islamic, if it's an Islamic culture, many Islamic forms, wherever it is believed that the Bible does not actually forbid that practice. So if the Bible doesn't forbid it, they say, hey, that could actually help us engage with people in this culture. And so it's not just things that have nothing to do with religion, but it's things that the Bible doesn't oppose or ban. Okay? C5. In this one, they are now viewed as Muslims by other Muslims. So to be part of this church, you're still a Muslim. But they're sometimes called Messianic Muslims, kind of like Messianic Jews. You don't have to stop being a Jew. You're a Messianic Jew now. So they'll reject or modify their unbiblical Muslim practices, but they're pretty generous about what they see as biblical and unbiblical. And so it's like, hey, like some would say the people that are kind of saying it's a bit too far would say, this is a group of people that don't care about the Bible, they're just trying to tag Jesus on. And then others would say, no, these are people that are doing a lot of cultural work and trying to find them. And then C6 is underground churches that just completely hide in the culture. And so in D.A. Carson's, just to pause, because I feel like we haven't done this in a while. Any questions about that? You get the spectrum of kind of what's happening there? C1 to C6. And it's like Western missionaries moving in and deciding how they want to do things. Is that all clear for everybody? Okay, now let's add some scripture to the way that we look at this. So this is from 1 Corinthians 9. I warned you it was 2 sermons, so it might take a little while to get all this out, but that's what we're in for today. So 1 Corinthians 9, Paul says this, and this is a thing that's often quoted when people are talking about how cultures come together to work together, especially to find ways to talk about Jesus together. He says, though I am free and I belong to no one, I have made myself a slave to everyone. I've made myself a slave. No one else has made me a slave. I've decided to make myself a slave to everyone to win as many as possible. To the Jews, I became like a Jew to win the Jews. To those under the law, sounds like the Jews again, but a little difference. Those under the law, I became like one under the law, though I myself am not under the law. So he's saying, I'm no longer under the law. I'm a Christian. I'm under the new law, which is a law of freedom. But I'm going to operate under the law so as to win those that are under the law. To those not having the law, I became like one not having the law. Though I'm not free from God's law, I'm under Christ's law, so as to win those not having the law. So you're getting the sense that Paul's saying, I'm going to try to make myself as much like the people that I'm in connection with so that I can have conversation with them that's meaningful. To the weak, I become weak. I became weak to win the weak. I've become all things to all people so that by all possible means I might save some. I do all of this for the sake of the gospel that I may share in its blessing. And so we read that, and we think of that in terms of the C1 to C6 spectrum, and we think, okay, well, if Paul seems to be saying, let's do absolutely anything we can come up with to help people hear the good news of what Jesus can do in their life. Except that in the rest of the letter, there's a whole bunch of other factors. It's like we can't just pluck this out of 1 Corinthians and say, this is the only thing we think about. Paul said, like, just go crazy, do whatever you want. None of it matters, just like be a chameleon, land in every culture, be just like the culture. And it's like, is there a place where we maybe step over the line? Like, to win the adulterers and becoming an adulterer. You know, like, he's definitely not saying that. It's just, we always jump to, like, extremes. I think you know the extremes. But if we jump to the extremes and we say, well, is Paul saying, like, we can do absolutely anything we want if we can justify it by saying that it's to Alright. Here's the thing. In the previous chapter, he's talking about food offered to idols, and he's saying, I have the right to eat food that's offered to idols, because we all know that the idols aren't real, that there's only one true God. And so as far as rights are concerned, I have the right to eat meat that's been offered to idols. But he sort of does this yes, but thing on several things in 1 Corinthians. Yes, I can eat the meat. It's not offered to a real God. And so I don't have any problem eating the meat. But I care about the people that would have a problem eating the meat. And so, yes, in my head, I know that I can eat meat that's been offered to idols, which later in the book, he talks about be careful worshiping, using meat that's been offered to idols or worshiping an idol. He's not saying I'm okay with worshiping idols to win people who worship idols. Not saying that. He's saying, I am allowed to eat that meat. I have a right to eat that meat. But something that challenges my rights, even more so than having rights, is the love I have for the person that would be hurt if I ate that meat. And then he talks about it the same way with speaking in tongues. He says, I speak in tongues more than all of you, but I'd way rather, yes, speak in tongues all you want, but I'd way rather speak one word in an intelligible language so people could actually understand. Because, yeah, I have the right to do these things, but what drives me is how people are responding or how people are experiencing how I'm using my rights. So I'm laying down my rights to be a person that engages for the love of the person instead of for fighting for my right. You see that? And there's multiple examples in 1 Corinthians where he seems to kind of have this, yes, yes, we know that's fine, but we care about the people that would be challenged by that. And so we lay down our right of what we know is fine to be there for the person that needs us.
D.A. Carson is funny in the way that he talks about it in this article. He says, like, say with alcohol, he says, I'm in a lot of circles where people say, you need Jesus and never to drink alcohol to be a Christian. And he says, anytime someone adds something to needing Jesus, I purposely say, well, pass the port. And he says, pass me the booze. Because in the world I live in, Jesus is enough. You don't have to not do something. Jesus is enough. And then he continues to say, like, I usually don't drink alcohol, but it isn't to make me a Christian. It's because the people that I'm connected with, I care more about them than my right to drink alcohol. He said, except for when I'm with friends. But I thought, like, what a great way of hearing how he's working. Okay, so we have sermon one, neighbor. And why in the world is the hero of the story? Well, maybe it's to bring respect to the people that sometimes are prejudiced against. Sermon two is this idea of laying down our rights, saying that there are things that we know are fine and good and we're allowed to do, but that when we're engaging in different cultures, our goal should not be to force our rights on people or to prove ourselves or to rationalize how we think about things, but to meet people in the struggles that they have. Okay, so there we go. Those are the two. Now let's bring them together. You might be sitting here thinking, so what does this have to do with truth and reconciliation and how we think about Indigenous or Aboriginal people in Canada? Well, I think the thing is that sometimes we think, what we need to do as Christians is just admit that everybody just needs Jesus. Like those Aboriginal people that I don't know, if I'm a white person speaking, just need Jesus. And maybe as a Christian Aboriginal person, we think, Aboriginals need Jesus. And maybe as another ethnicity who's following Jesus, we think,
Everybody needs Jesus. Great. We all agree everybody would benefit from knowing Jesus. Like, I think that's part of following Jesus. We think it's a good thing that Jesus is in the lives. But here's where it gets sticky, is that sometimes we think that the way people meet Jesus will only happen the way that we did. And so we think to ourselves, well, you know, if I am going to go plant a church in Japan, we need to sing English songs, and we need a C1 church, because that is real church. The moment we start speaking Japanese, this is like, I don't know what they're saying. And like, we've lost the level of control here. And then if we start playing with things, it might be, from my perspective, that's like demonic or something, because they're Japanese culture. I've never seen it before. C2, C3 churches. And so as much as we think sometimes when we talk about the First Nation situation, we look at our First Nations brothers and sisters and some of the historical ways that European sort of minded Christianity said, if you want to be Christians, you've got to do it our way. But the main problem, the big thing that we're confessing and that we're sorry for, is that in the way that the church entered along with European settlers, they said, if you want to be Christians, you got to stop being indigenous, which was the first lie. And then they didn't act very Christian in the way that they treated those that were indigenous. And so there's this sense of this friction of saying, well, what could have been? And if you listen to Marie Winston's story on the podcast this last week, she was an example of someone who grew up in an indigenous community off the grid, didn't go to residential school, and had this fantastic upbringing that was very rich, and had missionaries land in her village, teach her about Jesus. They started a First Nation community church where her grandfather was a preacher and taught Sunday school, all in the realm of indigenous practices that were theirs because they're indigenous. And so in the end, she has this incredible contrast of how this was a wonderful thing when the missionaries came to town, because it didn't strip them of their culture. And so you're not allowed to be indigenous because you have to experience Jesus through the narrow lens that I've seen it in Europe. And so it stands for me as a kind of contrast of what was lost when the lens through which we see Jesus replaced the beauty of Jesus. See the difference? And when you're wearing masks, I can't tell. You see it? A little bit of a difference there? Track it. All right, well, I know this is all over the place, but we're almost done. So today is our application, how you want to apply these things that we're learning. And so I just want to end with kind of tying it all together. As far as neighbors go, I've heard a lot in our processing, in our conversation with different people, where folks have said things like, you know, I just want to love the person in front of me. I just want to be a good neighbor to the person that's hurting, that's in front of me, and like whoever they are, wherever they come from, whatever's going on. I think I should just love whoever is in front of me. And I applaud that. I think that is a beautiful way to think. I think we have to go beyond that and think though structurally or in bigger ways, systemically. There's a time where, and Martin Luther King Jr. is famous for kind of referencing this, but sometimes we have to think about the structure that got us there in the first place, and how if it's broken, it's just going to keep happening. And I think that's what we're learning is true in Canada. So Martin Luther King Jr., I love how he says this. He says, on the one hand, we're called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will only be an initial act.
Okay, so if we see a hurting person, then hopefully that initial act draws us to help that hurting person. He said, but one day we must come to see that the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be constantly beaten and robbed as they make their journey on the highway. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It is not haphazard and superficial. It comes to see that an edifice which produces beggars needs to be restructured. That if people are getting robbed every time they go from Jerusalem to Jericho, there's a problem that's bigger just with helping the guy that got robbed on one day. The problem is that road is a place that is not safe. And so I think there's a sense where we respond to both of these sermons personally and corporately. Personally, how do we be a neighbor to people that are hurting when we see them? Personally, how do we see people that are products of a culture that's been in crisis that need extra help, extra support, extra kind of going the extra mile with folks like that? But then corporately, how as a community do we say we need to be a people that takes a role of advocacy because there's enough of us together, and many, and not many, but a portion of us are indigenous and can help our community see how to be advocates in our society. And so one of the ways that we thought we would apply that, sorry about your guitar here, Tom, is we thought we would just do something simple. It's not like we feel like this is answering everything, but this is our land of acknowledgement. Okay? It's something that just is a signal. Can you see that on the Zoom?
Yep.
It's our land acknowledgement. It's something that's a signal that we're aware of the fact that there's some tension around how land is used, and particularly how land is owned. And it's a signal to say that the way that we're going to own land as a community is with respect to the fact that it's something that we, despite the fact we have a right to own it, we're going to lay down that right in this way and say that it's not ours.
Can you see what it says? No, it's okay.
It's not just ours. It says, we acknowledge that we gather, live, play, and worship on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Stolo First Nation. We strive to be a diverse community who respects the land that we now share. And so we're going to hang this up in our entry so that anybody that uses this hall or that comes in recognizes that we work in our own land as a community is with respect to the people we share. Beyond that, I encourage you as individuals to be asking the question, what else can we do in advocacy that keeps what we're doing for this month in November 2020 as like a series where we took care of that whole reconciliation thing? We don't want that to be the history of New Heights. We want to be a church that continues to step into some of the calls to action, and that's going to end. So the calls to action, we're going to put them on the screen. So there's, I think it's 90 calls to action Truth and Reconciliation Commission put out, and these ones are aimed at the church. The first one we can skip because it's just for the Pope. We call the Pope to issue an apology. This is just for the Pope, and so since he's not here today, we will skip that one and go to the next one. Okay, so there's three that I think are pretty reasonable calls to action that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission have asked churches to consider. After this, I promise you I'm done. And we're going to have a couple songs to end for those in the state. It says, we call upon church parties to the settlement agreement to develop ongoing education strategies to ensure that their congregations learn about their church's role in colonization, the history and legacy of residential schools, and why apologies to former residential school students and families and communities were necessary. In other words, we're calling on churches to tell the story of why this mattered enough that we needed this. Why people, how people were hurt. Why apologies on a governmental level were necessary. And so that's what we're trying to do as a community. That's good. We can read that. The second, we call upon leaders of the church parties
the settlement agreement and all other faiths in collaboration with indigenous spiritual leaders, survivors, schools of theology, seminaries, and other religious training centers to develop and teach curriculum for all student clergy, so people that are becoming pastors, and all clergy and staff who work in Aboriginal communities on the need to respect indigenous spirituality in its own right. The history and legacy of residential schools and the roles of the church parties in that system, the history and legacy of religious conflict in Aboriginal families and communities, and the responsibility that churches have to mitigate such conflicts and prevent spiritual violence. In other words, is to say, let's have a more robust way that we think about the spirituality that's meaningful to Indigenous people and not saying it's all demon worship or evil. No. It's not. 61. We call upon church parties to the settlement agreement in collaboration with survivors and representatives of the Aboriginal organizations to establish permanent funding to Aboriginal people for community-controlled healing and reconciliation projects, community-controlled culture and language revitalization projects, community-controlled education and relationship-building projects, and then regional dialogues for Indigenous spiritual leaders and youth to discuss Indigenous spirituality, self-determination, and reconciliation. And so there we have it. But these are the things that from the government reconciliation project are aimed specifically at the church that says, if you want to be neighborly in a corporate way, as communities, we're just asking for these things, which I don't think are stepping outside of what it means to be a follower of Jesus by any means. I think it's actually embodying being a follower of Jesus, confronting the things that have been painful, and saying, let's tell these stories, let's talk as a community, let's listen to the Indigenous people that are part of our community, right here, even in New Heights, so that we can move forward together in a way where we're respecting. Next week is our embodying week, and one of the opportunities I think we're going to have, which is a little bit up in the air because of COVID, is on Saturday, the 21st, the Reach Art Gallery over in Abbotsford has an exhibit where some First Nation artists have taken colonial pictures of things that happened in our area and made a kid's book with First Nation art over top of the photos. And the artists are going to be there on that day giving out free books. And we've arranged for two viewings of that. I'm not sure if the artists will still be there. Later afternoon next Saturday. So we're going to be putting out sign-ups, provided that it's all a go, because everything with COVID is changing every 2 seconds. So, but I encourage you, if you want to educate yourself, if you want to be a little bit on the side of advocating for artists that are telling stories.